Our next topic on page 39 and 40 is Nochachut HaBa'al, the Hadar Leda, the question of whether the husband is allowed to be present when the wife gives birth. Now, the primary issue that we have to think about is whether or not any credence is going to be given to the feelings of the wife. Do we care in the slightest what she thinks, what she has to say? Is there any concern here? How are we going to relate to the concerns of the wife? That's the issue around which the great poskim disagree. The first source we have is the Igros Moshe, needs no introduction. He's quite familiar to everyone. The second source is the Minchat Yitzchak, Dayan Weiss, originally from I always get confused. There's two towns. I never remember which is which. He's either from Gross Vardein or Klein Vardein. I never remember. Klein Vardein or maybe Gross Vardein. Which one of those Vardeins, you know? And after the Holocaust, he was a Dayan in Manchester, in England, and then he eventually ended up here in Yerushalayim as the head of the Edah Haredit, putting him at the veritable top of the totem pole of Frumkeit. But I suppose totem pole is not a word we should use for here. Oh, yeah, okay. Well, you see, I, of course, have no idea what a totem pole is. I just bought a chicken in a bag, and I couldn't help but notice that the Hechsher printed on the label said that the Hechsher is valid only if the package is hermetically sealed. And I wonder whether or not the rabbis who wrote that knew anything about the incantations to Hermes, which are required by medieval alchemists to seal their vessels. I don't know. But then together with the chicken, I bought a few cans of Poseidon tuna fish. It's a strange world we live in. I, of course, only buy the most Mahadran tuna fish. The third source on the page is the Be'er Moshe, Rav Moshe Stern, originally from Debrecen. Debrecen, I think, is the second largest city in Hungary, isn't it? Still there, I guess. After the Holocaust, he ended up in New York, where he became the top-seated Hasidic posek of New York, and we'll see what he has to say. Now, if we get to it, and I know we will, I'm sure we'll get to Rav Yehuda Henkin at the bottom of the page. He is alive and amongst us today. He was, at the time he wrote this tshuva, he was the Rav of Beit Sha'an in the northern part of Israel. Today he lives in Yerushalayim. Those are the personalities here. I'm going to leave you to look at this stuff maximum 1 hour, and then we're going to get together and we'll have a shiur on the material.
We went through it. Well, just two of us went through it.
Oh, just two of you. Did everyone look at it? Should I just begin with the shiur?
Yeah.
Okay, why not? I'm flexible. Here goes.
There's a lot of room for discussion in there, okay, so 2 hours might be better.
Okay, let's see. Moshe Feinstein, we know very well who he is. He writes like this, and these are his words. Pesach Hadat, diverting the attention. Now, what he's talking about is what used to be called, well, still is, the Lamaze method of childbirth, which back in the 1980s, when he wrote this tshuva, the Lamaze method was the method of childbirth. It still underlies contemporary methods of childbirth. Lamaze method is a method in which the woman in labor diverts her attention from the discomfort of the contractions and birth. There are breathing exercises to be done. It's all a complicated procedure which, if practiced, enables her, when the time comes, to divert her attention from the discomfort of the contractions.
What decade did you say?
1980s. Hesach Hadat, diverting the attention, eino mo'il, doesn't work. Lehakel al tsar chevle leida, doesn't work. in reducing the discomfort of labor and delivery. Now, you see, here we are, a majority of men present, deciding what does and what does not affect women when they are in labor and giving birth. Yes?
I would like, if you don't mind, to counter something that you said, which is that breathing doesn't just divert the attention, it actually does have the effect of controlling pain.
No, it doesn't. He says it doesn't.
Well, perhaps I'm anecdotal then.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I can agree with that.
Halacha psukahi. It's the decision of Rav Moshe Feinstein that labor and delivery is labor and delivery, and there's nothing that can be done. Well, you can get anesthesia, you know, an epidural or something like this, but as far as anything aside from administering anesthesia is concerned, there's nothing that can be done to reduce the discomfort. Ach ima isha rotza liyot era b'shat leida. This was back in the 1980s. If the woman wishes to be awake during the birth, we're talking about a period where previously it was very, very, very common that women were given general anesthesia during birth. They were not awake at all. They slept through the whole thing.
That sounds fantastic. Why'd we stop that?
Because of the bad results and the bad results on the babies. But you know, well, and anyway, women are supposed to suffer. Doesn't it say that somewhere in the Torah?
You can have an epidural and be awake.
Epidurals do a good job. Epidurals do a good job. You see, so they say. All I know is what it says in the books. But bottom line, back in those days, when it was very common for women to sleep through labor and delivery because of anesthesia that was administered, he says, if a woman chooses to be more natural and wishes to be awake, there's no prohibition in that. We do not insist, halachically, we do not insist that she takes anesthesia. Ein bazed davar yisur, there's nothing prohibited about it. Mekol makom, in any event, hare zo nida, in any event, the woman is indeed nida, misha I efshala lalechet, from the point in time when she is unable to walk. If the contractions are minor at the beginning of labor, minor means she's still able to walk, even though she is having contractions, not yet nida. The idea... Correct. If there's bleeding, then I will make her nida earlier. But that's not so typical. It says in the Gemara, Ein ptichat kever lelo dam. The birth process where the baby comes out of the womb is always accompanied by bleeding. At what point in time do we have to assume that the bleeding has begun? From the point in time when the contractions are so strong that the woman is unable to walk. She might choose to sit down earlier, she might choose to lie down earlier, but as long as she's capable of walking, not yet nida. As the labor progresses, the contractions are going to get stronger and stronger, and at some point she'll be unable to walk, and then she will be nida. Ul'inyan isur nida, and as far as the prohibitions of nida are concerned, ne'aseret, misha yashva al hamashber, the words in the Gemara are, she is nida from the time she sits upon the birthing chair. The mashber is the birthing chair. Well, the Gemara says, from the time she sits on the birthing chair, she is presumed to be nida. Today we don't use, well, most hospitals do not use birthing chairs, they still exist, but from the time that she has to sit down, or from the time that she must lie down, she's unable to walk, that's when she is nida. Hu mishashi mashkivim ota b'mita mitzad hevlei leida, when she has to lie down, or sit down because of the contractions, that's when she's nida. Im hishochevet b'mita memele, if she's been lying in bed anyway for a while, V'kasha l'gboa hatchalat shat yitzur. If she's been lying in bed for a while because she chose to or was advised to, it might be difficult to figure out at what point in time she's unable to walk. But that's the problem. The halacha flows from the facts. It might be difficult to establish the facts, but that's it. Now, of course, in contemporary hospital practice, they always like to put in a needle for infusing fluids into the vein of the woman prior to giving birth. The reason they want to do this in contemporary hospitals is because sometimes there are emergency situations. Sometimes the staff has an emergency situation with this particular woman, and medicine has to be infused very, very quickly. And if the line has already been established, if the needle is already in place, then if there is an emergency, so the needle is already in place and the medicine can be given instantly. And therefore, in modern hospitals, they very strongly encourage the women to establish that needle line sometime early in labor so that it will be ready if needed later on. Now, once the needle is in place, they typically infuse liquids, water, a salt solution, the concentration of the molarity consistent with the molarity of blood. On fast days, and there's a fast day coming up, yes, on Sunday, on fast days, a woman who goes into labor on a fast day and shows up at the hospital knows that at some point they're going to be infusing her with fluids. So a clever thing might be for the woman to ask the staff to do it now. You know, you don't have to wait another half hour. Since you're going to do it anyway, put it in the line now. And if she's infused with fluids, she will surely feel a lot better. After all, fasting makes her feel bad. This will help her feel stronger, and this will help a lot. Even on Yom Kippur, this is true. Even on Yom Kippur, a woman who is fasting and goes into labor, so establishing the IV line, the Irui, the infusion line, early in the procedure will help her feel better. As we know, fasting, either on Tisha B'Av or on Yom Kippur, fasting for women who are at full term, women who are ready to give birth, fasting raises the question of whether or not these women who are at full term, should they fast, or is it safer for the pregnancy and the baby? Is it safer to eat and drink, or safer to fast? This is a question which has been studied in a fairly large, very large, around 2,500 women, fairly large clinical study. There are very few places in the world where there's a large pool of women who fast while giving birth. Yerushalayim is one of the few places in the world where a study like this can be done, and it was done a few years ago in Shaarei Tzedek Medical Center. And the bottom line results are more or less as follows. Women at full term tend not to go into labor while fasting. The theory is that the labor, there's a reason why they call it labor, right? Because it's a lot of work, right? That's why it's called labor in English. It's a lot of work. The body knows that in labor and delivery, a lot of energy is going to be required. It's a lot of hard work is a reason why the women are exhausted afterwards and take quite a while to recover. And if the body is fasting, so the body realizes through some mechanism that it's not in the best shape for labor and delivery, and onset of delivery in general does not occur while women are fasting. There are exceptions. In Shaarei Tzedek Medical Center, which is incidentally the world's largest birthing center, there are more births per year in Shaare Tzedek Medical Center than any other hospital in the world. It is by far the world's largest. The on Yom Kippur, the staff of the maternity ward is cut in half because they know they're going to have so few customers. When Yom Kippur is over, when the fast is over, and the ladies start eating and drinking again, and therefore their strength returns, that's the time when full-term women go into labor, and therefore, on the night after Yom Kippur, the staff in Shaare Tzedek is doubled, because that's when they start showing up in large numbers. As far as medical consequences are concerned, the result of the study is that for full-term labor, there are no medical consequences, there are no notable complications. Fasting seems not to have any effect at all on the course of labor or on the health of the baby when it's born. We're talking, of course, about normal pregnancies, a pregnancy which is complicated in any way, any unusual phenomena in a pregnancy. Of course, one will want to consult with the physicians who are treating the pregnant woman. The study has to do only with normal pregnancies. What on earth is all this interesting? Okay, she's Nida from the moment that she cannot walk. If necessary, mutar lebaal lihiyot shama lehashkiach. It's permitted for the physician to be present in the delivery room. The husband. It's permitted for the husband to be present in the delivery room to supervise. Shetasa davar b'seder hanachon, to make sure she does everything right.
She does everything right.
That is, she practiced her breathing exercises. She practiced all this stuff, and he can stand there and supervise to make sure that she's doing everything correctly as she practiced.
That's part of the mass.
A coach, now they have, what do they call it, the Olympics or something like that? I personally never got along very well with sports. That's in general. So maybe there's just something wrong, with me that I think coach is the wrong word to use for someone helping a woman in labor. I don't think of labor and delivery as being a sports event that requires a coach. I don't know. Maybe that's just something wrong with me, but in Hebrew they have a better term, tomechet. Tomechet leida, someone who supports the lady. The husband can be there. Gam lechazekota l'ametz liba. The husband can be there to offer her encouragement and to strengthen her heart. To offer encouragement. Of course, the husband can be there and encourage her. Af belo tzarech, even if there's no need for the husband to be there. You know, even if he's not going to contribute anything, ein isur b'davar, there's no prohibition for husbands to be present when their wives are giving birth. Of course, for generations, we husbands never did that. Of course, for generations, the lady folk sent us outside. But there's no prohibition to be there. And surely, if there's some good reason, then by all means, go for it. And there's no prohibition for the man to be present. Aval asur lo listakel b'yitziyat avlad mamash. The husband cannot watch the birth of the baby. It's quite typical in modern hospitals that the husband is asked to stand near the shoulders, near the head of the woman. And it's quite common in modern hospitals that they put a mirror so that the husband can actually watch the delivery of the baby. That's asur, according to Rav Moshe Feinstein. Why? Shehare asur lo listakel b'mekomot ha-mechusim sheba b'nidota. She is nida at the time, surely. When the baby is being delivered, she's nida. She became nida long before that. when she was unable to walk. She's neither, and while she is neither, he is not allowed to look at the parts of the body, parts of her body, which are normally covered. And therefore, of course, he can't actually watch the delivery.
Isn't via a mirror count as actually?
Yeah.
Because he uses the word mamas.
Yeah, it's all the same.
That makes it sound like it's you.
No. It's all the same. The Gemara already. The Gemara discusses the question of erva, looking at something which is immodest in a mirror, and the Gemara comes very quickly to the conclusion that if you see what you see, and if it's in a mirror, it's equally prohibited. The makam hatorfa means the place where the baby comes out. Asura fila b'tahara, when men shouldn't look there even if the wife is not nida. Ach kishi yizaher shelo yistakel, but if the husband is careful not to look at parts of the body which are normally covered, and indeed the woman who is in labor and giving birth is typically draped. I mean, she's clothed. Only those parts of the body which have to be exposed are exposed. So it's not a difficult thing for the husband to avoid looking at the parts of the body which are normally covered. As long as he avoids looking at those body parts, all is well. Leka isur, there's no prohibition. Al yidei mara, nami osa labal yistakel, mirrors are also prohibited. Well, this is the Gemara already established.
He doesn't mention the
Kiyah. Correct, he doesn't. He doesn't, but it follows from what he does say that since she's Nida, so he's not allowed to touch. He's not allowed to touch. He's allowed to speak to her, to encourage her. He's allowed to be present. He's allowed to supervise, but although he doesn't say it, it follows from his words, touching is prohibited. And in the Lamaze method, or the modern forms of the Lamaze method, touching is an important part of the issue. Touching is a very complicated business in our culture, very complicated issue. I of course am very modern. I'm very, very modern. I'm very, very, very modern.
The community you live in.
Very model of a modern
mother. They can't walk anymore. Let's say they're in the car on the way to the hospital. They get out of the car and...
Can't help her. Can't help her out of the car because she's neither.
Right now, what if... in other words, if she all of a sudden can't walk anymore, she cannot support her into the emergency room?
What about the kruach nefesh?
No, we learned that you could if you're the only one.
Yeah, well, if there's no one else who can help, then he can help. In general, the rule is if the wife is sick, just an ordinary garden variety sickness, and there is no one except the husband who can help her sit up, help her lie down, if there is no one who can help her, then the husband can. It would be preferable to hire someone to do it. Surely if you don't have to hire someone, surely if someone else can do it, someone else has to do it. But if there's no choice, there's no choice.
At that point, when we had the discussion about Derechiba,
Derechiba is not an issue in husband and wife. Derechiba is an issue only between men and women who are not married. But since they're married, so intimacy is the normal thing for them. Therefore, any contact is prohibited, unless it's pikuach nefesh. Okay. Now you'll notice in passing, Ikus Moshe is from the old generation, right? He was born in the beginning of the 20th century in Eastern Europe. Comes from the old culture, and what women have to say about the issue is irrelevant. We know what's best for the women, and we know that the Lamaze method is simply useless, and therefore prohibited because it becomes a violation of Nida. To be present, no one ever prohibited that. That's okay. And to encourage her with words, no one ever prohibited that. That's okay. But anything more is surely prohibited. Now, let's understand a little bit what's going on here. We already know that Rav Moshe Feinstein's general decision-making process, we've seen this before, we know that he wants to look at the basic sources, come away from the basic sources with a clear understanding of the principles, and apply them in the case at hand. Well, according to the sources, there is no prohibition for husbands to be present when the wives are nida. Everyone knows that. There is no prohibition for husbands to speak to wives when they are nida. Everyone knows that. And therefore, no problem here. Oh, but as far as anything else is concerned, the rules of nida should apply, and therefore, no touching.
Interesting how he starts off with the Hesed Hadar doesn't work, and then we're allowed to do Masiyah Hadar to talk to her and try to do it.
We're allowed to divert her attention after he tells us in the first line that it doesn't work. Of course, when he says it doesn't work, what he's talking about is touching. Yes, that doesn't work. curious, isn't it? Now, modern people like me know that hand shaking is passé. We, of course, don't shake hands. We fist bump. Yes? Now, correct me if I'm wrong. You know much more about what's going on outside the Beit Midrash than I do. Well, my impression, and I might be wrong about this, is fist bumping is primarily a male thing. Far more common among males than females. Yes?
Women do this.
High five.
Yes.
Mm. Women high five. Well, women hug.
Yeah, that's it.
I mostly don't fist bump men.
Yeah. Well, I think it's more a male thing. I don't know why. I suppose, if I had to guess, I suppose boys grow up fighting, and this is like an extension of boys fighting. After all, two male friends would have no difficulty expressing some kind of affection between themselves with a slap on the shoulder or a punch to the arm. That's something that boys do, but I think it's fairly unusual among girls. The Rav Moshe Feinstein comes from the old society. In the old society, physical expressions of affection were not seen in public. There was no such thing. A handshake, perhaps, but a handshake also is a very mild affair compared to the way handshakes are done in modern society. Well, next time you're at a Hasidic event, try shaking hands with a few of the Hasidim present, and you will discover what a mild affair hand shaking is. hardly any contact at all. That's the way it is. Now, back in those days, the movement for Lama's childbirth is dismissed more or less out of hand by Rav Moshe Feinstein. Dismissed out of hand for generations, for centuries, women have been giving birth without the Lama's method. It's all just silly. What has been working for countless generations of women should work equally well today, and it absolutely makes no sense to change anything. That's his approach.
Only allowing it, except for the touching,
Hold that idea.
I'm going to say it's been working fine. Woman dying in childbirth has dramatically decreased, even ever since he came onto the scene. So how can you say that historically the way, I mean, that's with kol hakavod to Rav Moshe Feinstein, believe me, right? Like, that's not true.
I don't think,
well,
I think
it's not Lamaze that's,
yeah.
Whatever it is.
Lamaze wasn't that's the missing piece.
Whatever it is.
It's part of it. Lamaze does, at least according to clinical studies which have been published, the Lamaze method did reduce complications in childbirth. The Lamaze method did make it safer. There are other elements in the story which are more important, but it is an element in the story. Remember that Rav Moshe Feinstein, hold this idea in mind because it's going to be very important when we compare it to the next source. Rav Moshe Feinstein is the one voice in the rabbinic world who always insisted that everything follow the strict rules of halacha. Halacha is what is important, and if everything is in accord with halacha, all is well. And this is reflected in his tshuva. Is it permitted for men to be present? There's no prohibition. It's okay. Is it permitted for the men to encourage their wives? No prohibition. It's okay. Hold this idea in mind, because the next guy in the middle of the page is going to prohibit all of this, right? What is halachically permitted is fine. This was the battle cry of Rav Moshe Feinstein throughout his time in America. This was, in my opinion, the principal reason that he was so beloved. The principal reason why the Americans loved Rav Moshe Feinstein and embraced him so warmly was because he was the one and the only one who was willing to say over and over and over again, do whatever you want as long as it's not us. You want to dress like an American? Dress like an American, as long as there's no shatnez in your clothing. Meanwhile, all the other rabbanim were saying, you cannot dress like an American, you have to dress like a Jew. Rav Moshe Feinstein said, you want to eat like an American? Fine. Let's just talk about how many pieces of pizza require netilat yadayim. Meanwhile, all the other rabbanim were saying, no, you have to eat Jewish food, gefilte fish and chulent. Rav Moshe Feinstein said, you want to educate your children like Americans? Fine. Let's just make sure they also have correct Limud HaKodesh. Meanwhile, all the other Rabbanim were saying, no, you can't have any American schooling. You want to speak English? Rav Moshe Feinstein said, fine, there's no Isur in that. Meanwhile, all the other Rabbanim were saying, no, you have to speak Yiddish. You have to speak the language of your parents and grandparents. Rav Moshe Feinstein was the one whose voice tirelessly fought for halacha and only halacha as being important. If you're halachically correct, all is well. That was his position. And the Americans loved him. Absolutely loved him for that. Now, on the other hand, Minchas Yitzchak, the second source, he wasn't actually born in Hungary. He was born in Poland, but he was active in Hungary before World War II. He represents the majority view of the old-time Rabbanim. Let's see what he says. Kevan she'asur lebaal ligabi ishto nida. Since it's prohibited for a husband to touch his wife when she is nida, afilu hi chola, even if she's sick, unless there's no one else who can do what has to be done. B'shulchan Aruch lo naknu etzel lasot al yedei kvafot. Shulchan Aruch could have said, anyone might have said, that if she's sick and he has to help her, let him wear gloves. Kfafot. Let him wear gloves. They're going to the hospital, driving to the hospital together, and she's already nida and needs some help out of the car into the hospital. Let him equip himself with some gloves. No one ever suggested gloves as a basis for leniency where there's a prohibition of touching. If there's a prohibition of touching, so gloves or being clothed doesn't help. If the physical contact is prohibited, it's prohibited, even if you're wearing gloves or otherwise clothed. Since that's true, he draws the following conclusion. Asur l'baal ligabi ishto b'shat hevle leida. Husband is not allowed to touch his wife during labor, afilu al yedei kfafot, even with gloves on. And up till this point, his conclusion is simple, straightforward, and halachically identical with everyone else. Af al pi sheyesh makom l'hakel b'mkom sakana, even though there is room for leniency in life-threatening situations, and everyone knows that the prohibitions of the Torah in general get set aside in life-saving situations, and the prohibitions of husband and wife touching during nida, these are rabbinic prohibitions after all, not even Torah prohibitions. Of course, these prohibitions would be set aside in life-saving scenarios, even though that's true. Nonetheless, Hare Nashim Ta'atan Kalot. Women are flighty. Women are flighty. Yeah, well, everyone knows that. Women are not, just not serious. They're frivolous. Women are just, their minds are weak. And, women will just say, anything. I mean, women will just say anything that flies into their heads at any particular moment, and therefore, we men cannot take seriously anything that women say, because women are not serious creatures, and therefore, we cannot take seriously any claims made by those ladies. Yesh lachush shemivakshot shebaalehem yigru bahem. We have to be afraid that the ladies are requesting that their husbands touch them during the Lamaze method. Mishum kalas das, because the women are simply not serious, because they're frivolous, because they have no serious commitment to Torah and mitzvahs. Lo mishum teiruf hadat.
Is it because of that?
Yes.
Because they have no commitment.
Yes, if they were really committed, they would not request such a foolish thing.
I feel really sorry for his wife and daughters.
She feels sorry for his wife and daughters. Well,
no, he's just on a level that I can't even react.
Because he doesn't draw the conclusion from his own experiences. He's from the Gemara.
Well, yes, and of course he was never present when his wife was in labor, and for labor and delivery, he was of course never present. Whether he discussed it with her at some point, I have no idea, but it doesn't matter whether he would discuss it with her. He wouldn't believe anything she says. As you correctly point out, the Gemara already said, Nashim da'atan kalot, women's opinions are not to be taken seriously. Now, you people, well, it's true. How can you take women seriously? Look,
doesn't
Ruri appear in the Gemara?
Yeah, you have a few examples like this. But look, I am not so old. Yes, I am not so old. But I am old enough to remember the old days, which was not so long ago. I remember headlines in newspapers growing up, for the first time a woman has been appointed as judge somewhere. I remember headlines in newspapers, for the first time a woman has become a professor at some university. It's not so long ago that there was no such thing as taking women seriously in the public domain. That's the way the world was back then. Things have changed, but he's from the old world. And in the old world, women have no place at the table. They have no, they cannot participate in the discussion. Their opinions are simply worthless.
When did he write this?
This was written in the early 80s.
I suspect that what's bothering so many people here is that childbirth is not a matter of the public domain, but an intensely personal and private thing, and therefore of a different magnitude.
Those flighty women claim that the Lamaze method is going to make them calmer, and that the calmness is going to reduce the dangers in labor and delivery. All this happens to be true based on clinical studies which have been done. That's the claim they make, but it's all just nonsense. There is no benefit here. There is no benefit. There is no problem of teiruf hada'at. There is no problem of what's the opposite of calmness? There is no problem of stress. There is no problem of stress. It's have bichlal sakana. If there were a problem of stress, if we were relieving stress, then of course relieving stress contributes to the safety of labor and delivery, and that's eliminating some of the dangers to life. But that's all just not true. It's simply not true. There is no benefit, no medical benefit to the Lamaze method. And therefore, it's simply
was aware of clinical studies which were done in the 80s.
You know, the Minchas Yitzchak wouldn't care about them either.
I understand, but Ramosha, as long as the studies weren't done by women,
yeah.
wouldn't that be a potential factor?
So the Minchas Yitzchak, Ramosha doesn't seem to think anything's wrong.
No, but touching, but maybe Ramosha would be lenient about touching.
Right,
he would
but
be
he's
convinced.
Saying that you wouldn't take seriously studies done by women. I don't think Ramosha would
no.
studies
by
women.
Yeah.
If
Rav Moshe Feinstein would have been convinced that the facts are that the Lamaze method, husband and wife touching, reduces the danger of labor and delivery, if he had been convinced of that fact, I'm sure he would have permitted it. Unlike the Minchas Yitzchak, who says you cannot prove such a thing, we just dismiss out of hand the evidence. If there are studies like this, they're either lying or misunderstand the data they collected. They're just wrong. Okay, the Minchas Yitzchak has no room to accept modern science. Just reject it out of hand. If you think about it for a moment, the approach of the Minchas Yitzchak, who rejects out of hand the validity of modern science, the evidence is wrong, they merely are misunderstanding the evidence that they look at, and therefore their conclusions are simply wrong. That applies to all of modern science. This approach, although you might not like it, this approach is very cogent, very forceful. There's not a single crack. You cannot attack this position. This position is ultimately defensible because the position is rooted in the idea that any evidence brought against me is invalid. Well, if you begin with the position that any evidence brought against my position is invalid, so there's no way to attack such a position. And that's the Minchas Yitzchak.
What's the harm? Like, we're looking at it like that it could do good for the woman, but she says no.
Neither. What's the harm?
So why do we have the Har HaKod? We're worried that one thing will lead to another.
Yeah, and here.
But how can you say that one thing is going to lead to another in this case?
Chazal said that it's prohibited. Because one thing will lead to another,
but
therefore
she's
it's
giving
prohibited.
Birth.
No, it's prohibited because one thing will lead to another, and and
but that's what I'm saying, but that's not the case here.
Yes, yes, yes.
She can't physically get out of the bed to mix fans with
her. Couldn't even do anything. The baby's coming up.
Ain't my lasso. Top of feather. This doesn't interest him in the slightest, because the Isser de Rabbanan is lo plug, flat out prohibition, and that's all there is to it. Okay. It's true that the rabbinic prohibition of the Har Hakot were introduced so that they will not come to prohibited intercourse. That's true. But once the Har Hakot are prohibited, they're prohibited flat out in every situation, including this one. That's his approach.
How do you know that he's not accepting science?
Oh, I know it's based on other true vote.
He only says here that he's not accepting what women tell him.
Yeah.
But is he maybe not aware of...
No, I know this based on other true vote, which he's written. The most famous controversy revolves around Brit Milah, which takes place on Shabbat. Brit Milah, I guess approximately 1/7 of all births end up with Brit Milah on Shabbat, I suppose. It's very common. Very common. It says in the Gemara that the baby on... I spoke about Brit Milah on Shabbat. That's not what I meant to say. I meant to say Brit Milah on Wednesday, so the third day after Brit Milah is on Shabbat. If the third day after Brit Milah is on Shabbat, there the Gemara says the baby is in special danger. The danger to the baby rises on the third day after Brit Milah, and therefore on the third day after Brit Milah, the baby has to be bathed in hot water. We use British English or American English? Yes?
American.
American English does not distinguish between bathing and bathing. We use the same word for both. Is that okay?
Yes.
Okay. The between bathing and bathing? Yes. One has to do with washing yourself. The other has to do with going into the water and having fun.
Really?
Which? Bathing is to get clean. Bathing is to get clean. Bathing is when you go with your friends and have a good time in the water.
I'm an ignorant Canadian.
Why is it of interest? The Mogen Avraham. The Mogen Avraham wrote in the 17th century. The Mogen Avraham wrote, "Nishtanu hatva'im." The facts of nature have changed. The fabric of reality has changed. In the days of the Gemara, it was correct to heat water on Shabbat in order to bathe the baby if on the third day after Brit Milah. Of course, the hot water should have been prepared before Shabbat, but if for some reason the water was spilled, or if you didn't have hot water prepared before Shabbat, pikuach nefesh. Life-threatening situation demands that water be heated on Shabbat to wash the baby on the third day after Brit Milah. That's what the Gemara says, that's what the Rambam says, that's what the Torah says, that's what the Shulchan Aruch says. The Magen Avraham in the 17th century wrote, "Nishtanu hatva'im," the fabric of reality has changed, the facts of nature have changed, the third day is no longer so dangerous, and therefore, bizman hazeh, nowadays it is prohibited to heat water on Shabbat for this purpose in a normal, healthy baby. Now, cynical people like me wonder when we have shinui hateva, when we have cases like this, where the facts of nature have changed, when we have these cases, cynical people like me wonder, do the facts of nature change simultaneously everywhere in the world? Or is it a ripple effect? The change began in Poland in the days of the Magen Avraham and slowly spread out and eventually reached Morocco. That is, what about the Jews in Morocco who were heating water on the third day after Brit Milah on Shabbat for babies? because it says in the Rambam, and it says in the Gemara, and it says in the Shulchan Aruch, that's what you're supposed to do. And the new information from the Magen Avraham had not yet arrived. Are they guilty of violating Shabbos and eventually have to bring a Korban Chatas for that purpose? Or maybe the fact of nature had not yet changed in Morocco. Cynical people like me worry about issues like that. Now, once the idea of Shinui HaTeva changes in the fabric of reality, changes in the laws of nature, were introduced by the Magen Avraham, the idea has taken hold and become quite popular among contemporary poskim. There are plenty of examples out there. For example, it says in the Gemara that lice in the hair, yes? Lice, kinim, it says in the Gemara that they reproduce. Well, they don't reproduce at all. They come into being through spontaneous generation. Filth and sweat produce lice. They come into being through spontaneous generation. And since they come into being through spontaneous generation, it says in the Gemara, and the Rambam, and the Torah, and the Shulchan Aruch, it says there's no prohibition at all in killing lice on Shabbat. Although killing a creature is one of the 39 prohibited labors on Shabbat, that has to do with creatures that came into being through the normal procedures.
Is that anything with borer? Like, can you use a comb?
No, borer is still prohibited.
But you're just removing the lice from the hair.
According to the Gemara, you can kill the lice. You can crush them.
But you can't do whatever you want with them.
Borer is still prohibited.
You still have to leave the dead.
Okay. Okay, but you can crush them according to the Gemara and all the poskim. Mrs. Cohen taught us in the third grade that there is no such thing as spontaneous generation. Mrs. Cohen taught us in the third grade that every creature has parents, at least one parent. Whom are we to believe? The rabbis and all the halachic sources, or what modern science teaches us? And here the difference in halacha is vast. According to the traditional rabbinic sources, it's permitted to kill lice. According to the biological view, it's one of the 39 prohibited labors on Shabbos, Chayav Chatas. That's a big difference.
Many poskim
like this idea of Shinui HaTeva. Shinui HaTeva, changing the saying that the laws of nature changed, that gives you your cake and you can eat it too. You can say they were right. And we're also right. You don't have to say that the rabbis of the Gemara made a mistake. You can say they were right in their days. But things have changed, the facts have changed, and therefore the halacha has to change accordingly. The problem with this, unfortunately, is that the life cycle of the louse is perfectly visible to ordinary vision. You don't need a microscope for this one. I mean, anyone who has taken lice out of a child's hair knows that the louse is small, but you can see it. I mean, anyone with ordinary vision can see a louse. With a little bit of patience, you can see the boy and the girl louse get together. With a little bit more patience, you can see the egg laid. With a little bit more patience, you can see the egg hatch and the louse come out. I mean, you don't need a microscope for this one. All you need is a little bit of patience. There are plenty of things in the Gemara, plenty of scientific facts mentioned in the Gemara where we think they were wrong, but they could not have known better. As we mentioned earlier in the week, they said there are two membranes surrounding the brain. Modern physiology textbooks say there are three membranes surrounding the brain, but the third is microscopic. They didn't have microscopes, so there's no way they could have known about the third membrane. An error where they could not have known better is surely more tolerable than an error where they should have known better if they would have only looked. Yes? Well, as far as the Minchas Yitzchak is concerned, we just say fooey regarding all modern science. What it says in the Gemara is correct. Lice do come into being through spontaneous generation. The biologists who say otherwise are simply wrong. They misunderstand what they are looking at. If they would look again more carefully, they would realize that what it says in the Gemara is correct and literally true. That's the approach of the Minchas Yisroch. Very different than the approach of the Igros Moshe, for example. Rav Moshe Feinstein.
So if we can be clear, a follower of this position would have no hesitation killing a louse.
Correct.
On
correct. Of course, you can kill lice on Shabbos. It says so in the Gemara. It says so in the Rambam. It says so in the Torah. It says in the Shulchan Aruch. Of course, it's permitted. It even says in the Mishnah Berurah. Mutter.
But there are others who would say.
Say Yechayv Chatas.
Okay.
So it depends how frum you want to be. Of course, here the notions of frumkeit are turned on their head. Because it's the old time Rabbanim who are on the Makel side, and it's the ones who embrace modern science who are on the Machmir side. This is the reverse of the normal situation. But look, killing lice on Shabbos, as interesting as it is maybe not the most important issue in contemporary halacha. There are other issues which are truly important. After all, it says in the Torah, does it not, that Petua Daka, a male whose genital organs are damaged, is anal molid, he's infertile, and since he's anal molid, infertile, he's not allowed to get married. And if he does get married, he has to get divorced. That's what it says in the Mishnah. So it says in the Gemara, and all the poskim, Shulchan Aruch, the whole works. That's what they all say. A male whose genital organs are damaged, the anal molid, he's infertile, can't get married, and if he is married, he has to get divorced. Now, the Gemara, of course, has long discussions about how to define which lesions, what kind of injuries, put a male into this category. Turns out to be important to know. And among the lesions which definitively put the male into the category of Petzua Daka is a Nikav Habetza, a testicular puncture. And indeed, the Gemara has a specific example of a man to which this happened. He sinfully refused to divorce his wife, which is what he should have done according to the halacha. His wife subsequently became pregnant and gave birth. And the rabbis declared that baby to be a mamzer because he suffered a nikuv habetza, a testicular puncture. It was an accident happened to him. Therefore, he's anal molid, infertile, and therefore there must have been an act of adultery here, and the child was declared to be a mamzer. So this is a severe issue. Now, in modern medicine, In contemporary medicine, male infertility is usually treatable. There are very few cases of male infertility which cannot be resolved in modern medicine. The problem is that modern medicine, in order to treat male infertility, first requires a diagnosis. There's a long list of things which can cause male infertility. You have to figure out exactly what the cause is, and then a course of treatment can be instituted. That's the way modern medicine works. Now, part of the diagnostic procedures which are necessary in cases of male infertility, part of the diagnostic procedures which are necessary is a testicular biopsy. Now, a testicular biopsy is a procedure which does exactly what the Gemara says makes a male infertile. And today, it's part of the procedure for reversing male infertility. And in modern medicine, einenu haraot, we see with our own eyes that male infertility can be successfully reversed And part of the procedure is the testicular biopsy in order to have a proper diagnosis in order to know what the course of treatment is. Igris Moshe, in discussing exactly this question, has not the slightest problem in saying, behold, nishtana hateva. The fabric of reality has changed. The facts of nature have changed. Back in the days of the Gemara, a procedure like this would make a male infertile. Today, we see that it's no longer true, and therefore there's no objection to the marriage nowadays.
That's not teva person or teva of like...
The rules of nature. The rules of nature.
Isn't it more reasonable to say Nishtana had true thought? Like that medicine
has changed? No, Nishtana.
Saying that the male body has changed?
No.
Is it more reasonable to say
that? That could be an argument for evolution.
Evolution? No. Evolution.
We can't
open up that can of worms. Now, I explain to you. Vesevius, is Vesevius a well-known name?
Is what?
Vesevius. Vesevius.
Vesuvius. Not the volcano.
No. Vesevius. Was a Vesalius, also spelled with an L. He was a physician back in early 17th century France. He was a teacher in the University of Paris. His field was teaching human physiology. He was the first of the scientists to perform post-mortem dissections. The first scientist to actually cut apart human cadavers and examine the internal organs, he was the first. Prior to him, this was simply not done for various cultural reasons. He was the first. And among the discoveries that he made was that the gross anatomy of the human liver is very, very different from the anatomy of the liver as described by Galen. Galen was the classical textbook on human anatomy. That was the classical textbook which was used since antiquity, through the Middle Ages, into early modern times. That was the textbook for human anatomy by Galen. And the description of the liver in Galen is very different from the livers which Vesevius or Vesalius observed in 17th century Paris. He wanted the faculty on the University of Paris Medical School, he wanted them to change the curriculum to teach what the liver really looks like. Of course, the rest of the faculty rose up as one against him. We cannot change the traditional curriculum, which has been in place since antiquity. Galen said this is the correct form of the liver, and that is what we must teach. After all, Galen was describing the healthy Greek liver, and here in 17th century Paris, you're just looking at the diseased French livers. And we have to teach the ideal liver as described by Galen. This is exactly what Vesalius said. Vesalius was in the history of the Western world the first person to suggest the facts of nature have changed. The liver used to look like Galen describes it. Today, the liver looks like what we see here in Paris today. And since the facts of nature have changed, we must change the curriculum accordingly. That's what Vesalius proposed in the beginning of the 17th century. 20 years later, the Magen Avraham proposed what he proposed in a halachic context. And that's become quite popular, as I indicated, nowadays. Okay? There are many other approaches to these underlying problems. Many other approaches. But this is probably not the forum to go into all of them.
Can I ask a question taking us back to this topic?
Yeah, sure.
What if your wife is more modern, more secular, and really demands of you that it's a real issue of shalom bayis, not an issue of she's lightheaded
Like, it's a real, if you don't hold her hand right now, she is going to
slap you upside down.
Divorce you or whatever, or hate you for the rest of your marriage.
Good, good.
I actually have a story that
that's good.
Where there was I know someone who his wife was very, very firm from birth, and he said, I want to be strict and I want to not be in the room when you deliver, because I want to take on a homer to not be in the room when you deliver.
Okay.
And she said no. And they fought about it. Eventually, he was in the room, and a couple of years later, she divorced him.
Yeah, of course. Look, see, you guys have all been poisoned by modern culture, and you must shake off the poisoning, the perversions of modern society, and return to the true social standards of pre-modern times. As far as this issue is concerned,
so we can, but our wives cannot.
Yeah, no, they have to. Well, wives.
That's Carlos Roche. How can they
The wives too have to return to the old ways. I explain to you. The following idea, you know, it's so one of the hardest things in the history of ideas, one of the hardest things in intellectual history is to be able to view things from the old point of view. Now, we are so accustomed to looking at things from the modern point of view, it's just hard to imagine how things were different in earlier generations. Here goes a challenge for you to try to internalize the following idea. Here goes. In modern marriages, 300 years ago began modernity. Okay, prior over the last 300 years, marriages have largely been based on men and women liking each other. Romance between man and woman liking each other and getting married, is a modern idea which did not exist in the world until around 300 years ago. In the old society, one could very easily imagine a conversation between parents talking about their married children. They hate each other. You know, our married children hate each other. They scream and fight daily, but it's okay. They are financially secure and they have good social standing, and that's what's important. That's in the old society. In the modern society, you can very easily imagine two parents speaking with each other about their married children. They're living in poverty. They can't get a job. They have no social standing. But at least they love each other, right? things, what marriage is all about.
Not ever.
What marriage is all about has changed dramatically. It went from, in the classical period, antiquity, in the Middle Ages, marriage was all about social standing, financial security, and producing the next generation. That went to a change in modern society where marriage is all about romance and producing the next generation. And over the last very few years, we've been witness to another seismic change, another earthquake, where producing the next generation has dropped out of the recipe and we're left only with romance. In the very modern marriage, over the last few years, what marriage is all about is emotional commitment. If you have emotional commitment, that's what it's all about. And everything else has dropped out of the recipe.
You don't need marriage.
Well, no, marriage is the expression of the commitment. romantic connection is one thing. A commitment to ongoing romantic attachment, that's something else. That's what marriage is all about.
Isn't that what the ideal Torah marriage is? Between Am Yisrael and God, it's all about the emotional commitment.
That's a fine example. The world literature, Greek literature, Roman literature, Arabic and Persian literature, Torah literature in its broadest sense, all world literature, Lahavdil, Torah literature, is chock full of romance. Absolutely chock. I mean, that's a big topic in world literature, romance. But in the whole history of world literature, including Lahavdil, Torah literature in its broadest sense, from Chumash to Midrash and everything else, there's not a single example in the whole of world literature of romance between husband and wife until modern times. Now that's an awful lot of silence. It's an awful lot of silence. You're correct.
What
the
about
romantic,
the tragedy?
The romantic connection is clearly described between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Am Yisrael, but never in a context between husband and wife.
Just Yaakov and Rachel.
Where do you see that?
You love Rachel more than
one. Let me tell you, one word in the Chumash does not a love story make.
Every word is an infinite.
Yeah, okay, not so excited. No, you need more. Read a love story and you'll discover that it's one word doesn't do it. And he loved her is not it. The words he loved her is not a love story make. I do not deny throughout history that husband and wives loved each other. I'm sure. But that was a plus. That was a bonus. That was an unexpected benefit if it happened. Back in the old days, failure of emotional closeness in marriage was not thought of as being a failure. No one expected it. The modern marriage, on the other hand, is an emotional pressure cooker, because the modern marriage begins with high expectations of emotional closeness. Failure of emotional closeness in the modern marriage, that's a big problem. In earlier days, when it was never an expectation, if it happened, hinei matov. That was a plus. That was a benefit.
Over time of giving to each other.
Okay.
Classic marriage here, right?
Okay. Dumb.
That fits in with what we were saying earlier about the school of thought of Rav Moshe, that back then emotions and feelings and love weren't expressed.
Correct. Weren't expected.
So it was the same thing within the marriage.
Correct. Well, Rav Moshe Feinstein is a fine example. His own personal marriage. Rav Moshe Feinstein had one wife. He's never remarried, of course. Had one wife his whole life. Five children, I think. I think three in Europe, two in America. Don't know exactly the numbers. But when Rav Moshe Feinstein lived in Russia with his family, we mentioned the other day that he built a secret mikveh, right? And Mrs. Feinstein was of the opinion that the mikveh that her husband built was halakhically invalid, and for a period of 7 years she did not attend the mikveh. There was no other mikveh. When they came to America, Rav Moshe Feinstein, to get a visa to come to America from Russia, part of the deal was he needed a job offer in the United States before you could get a visa to come to the United States. So the Jews in America made arrangements for Rav Moshe Feinstein to have an offer to be a rabbi of some little shul somewhere in Illinois, in some little town in Illinois. So the Feinsteins arrived in New York, and Rav Moshe Feinstein said, "No, I have to go to Illinois. I agreed to be the rabbi there for a period of 6 months. It was a six-month contract." He went to Illinois by himself, left the rest of the family in Brooklyn, and he went to Illinois for 6 months to fulfill his contract, and then he came back to New York, where he became the Rosh Yeshiva in the Lower East Side, and Rav Moshe Feinstein lived in the Lower East Side, right near the Yeshiva, but his wife continued living in Brooklyn. They didn't get together again for around 6-7 years.
that's like Moshe at Moshe, like Moshe Rabbeinu also separated from his wife.
Yeah.
Wait, yeah. How did they have seven kids? Five kids.
I think it was three then, two in America. I'm not sure. Well, apparently they did get together occasionally. Apparently they did get together occasionally. But I'm saying the expectation, there was no expectation of emotional closeness. That is, that shidduch was arranged between him and her because of social standing, because of economic security. There was no expectation of emotional closeness, and therefore it never occurred. Once I had an appointment to speak with Rav Moshe Feinstein, and I arrived punctually on time. When I knock on the door, this is when they were living together in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, she opens the door. She asks me what I want. I say I have an appointment to talk to the Rav. She says, so he's in there. So I go over there, and she's learning Gemara. Learning. I stand there, 5 minutes, 10 minutes. She's learning Gemara. I stand there, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes. And around 15 minutes, she comes by, and she says, "Ugh, you're still standing here. Look, he's learning Torah. If you don't interrupt him, he'll be there all day."
So your interaction with her?
Yeah, this is my interaction with the Rebbetzin. Yeah. It wasn't a modern marriage.
Eventually, they did live together on a permanent basis.
Yeah, sure. They did. They got together again.
Just different. They came together later.
Yeah. Okay. Look, what do I know about the emotional dynamics in their family? But they came from the old world, and in the old world, see, today, modernity comes at different times in different parts of the world. There are plenty of places in the world where modernity has not yet come, where they're still living in the old culture, and. Yeah, sure. In my holy neighborhood, there are many of my neighbors are still living in the old culture, where it seems perfectly reasonable that boy and girl have nothing to say about getting married. It's a decision made entirely by the families. After all, what would the boy and girl have to say about it? There's nothing they could say about it. The idea of emotional closeness is just foreign to them. It's not an expectation in marriage, and therefore boy and girl have no input at all. It's the parents who will decide whether or not the union will provide social security within society and economic security. That's what the parents will decide.
How can the Torah be silent on like one of the most important issues
in modernity?
No, not in modernity. No, because then the Torah should say what these people are doing. Like if that's the halakha, it's nothing to do with this. These are the factors.
Things change. Look.
If they one way or the other.
The people living in the old society function very well. People living in a new society function as well as they function. The problems are when you're living on the cusp of modernity, when the parents are still in the old world and the children are in the new world, then that's a generation gap. There you really have problems. But you know, as long as everyone is operating with the same expectations or lack thereof, so things work fairly smoothly. But when modernity arrives and the children want to live one way and the parents expect them to live a different way, then you have problems. We're not going to solve those problems here. But let's see if we can figure out the end of the Minchas Yitzchak. It says, Kviat Chashash Teru Chadar, determining whether or not there's a problem of stress. The whole Lamar system is designed to minimize stress. Determining whether or not there is a problem of stress is all misura, all the job of morech ora. It's the job of the rabbi to decide whether or not the woman will be in stress. We don't listen to her, we listen to the rabbi. Kfi Tzorach HaSha'a Shelo L'Hakel B'Dvar L'Ma'an Lo Yizalzulu HaHamon. It's the rabbi's job to stand strong and not allow any leniencies in this matter, because the moment that the rabbi admits any leniency in the relationship between husband and wife in the delivery room, the Hamon Am, the masses out there, are going to start to be lenient, and there goes the whole principle of Har Haka down the tubes, and all of Hilchus Nida is going to be lost.
He's opening it up to case-by-case basis.
In theory, but in practice, as the rabbis have to always stand firm.
It's
Tzorach HaSha'a is that the rabbis have to stand firm and not allow any changes.
Right. To the Hamon, we're not going to ever write this, but I need to know the woman, and if I knew the woman and she's subject to
no, there's no such thing.
And anyhow, what do you expect the rub to be in the rough?
Hands during the pregnancy, during the birth, then for sure afterwards, 3 months later or whatever, when they're half a clutter out the window.
The Tzorach HaSha'a, the contemporary requirements of the rabbi, the Tzorach HaSha'a, the requirements of the rabbi are to stand firm and not allow any leniencies, period.
We
can't allow any leniencies.
Somebody coming to read this 30 years later might read it.
Maybe. But what we see here, is the fundamental difference between Rav Moshe and the Minchas Yitzchok. That Rav Moshe, all he cared about was halacha. Yikov hadin et ahar. Let us figure out exactly what is permitted and what is prohibited. Aside from that, live your life however you wish to live it. Minchas Yitzchak, we dare not change anything. Lidorei dorot, for countless generations, this is the way birth was done. We dare not change it. That's what he says.
Would he be against epidurals and that kind of medication?
I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised. I do not know what his position was. No published tshuva. Uh-huh. I would not be surprised. No.
But he says halacha is an unchanging body.
You got it. And we must fight to prevent any crack in the wall, because any change will lead to who knows what. That was the voice of the old rabbis, as against the unique voice of Rav Moshe Feinstein. Change anything you want, as long as it's halachically correct. And the Americans love Rav Moshe for this. Okay, let's take a look at the Ber Moshe. Rav Moshe Stern, I introduced him before, originally from Debrecen. He was asked about Inyan Mivohal Meturaf. He was asked about an insane idea. Someone asked him about a crazy idea, an absolutely insane idea someone asked him about. Lo Sha'aru Avaseinu. Someone asked him about an insane idea which our fathers and forefathers never dreamt of. Hainu, namely, Shebashasa Leida Mamish, that at the time of delivering, Habalya Amod Letzad Ishto, the husband should stand next to the wife. Yechaz biyadeya, husband should hold his wife's hands. Yimash meshba, and should rub her hands. Derech hiba, in a loving way. Yidaber aliba, the husband should speak to the heart of the woman, should speak to her emotionally. Al yadeizeh, and by means of this, he lo targish tsar leida, she can alleviate at least some of the pain of giving birth. So someone asked him about this insane Lamaze system, which of course our rabbis through the generations never dreamt of. Tshuva. Here's his tshuva. Asur ligar ulistakel. Simply prohibited. Kal v'chomer limashmesh biyadeya derechiba. All the more so is it prohibited to rub her hands lovingly. You know, there's a big many, it says in the, a lot of Rishonim, many Rishonim, say, Asur Limashmesh et Dofek Ha'isha. If a woman is sick, it is prohibited for a man to take her pulse, to see what her pulse rate is. Right? Establishing the pulse rate, the number of beats per minute, tells you a lot about the health of a patient. Well, if it's a male physician, well, all the physicians were males in those days, and a female patient, it's simply prohibited for the male to take the pulse of the female patient. Plenty of Rishonim say this. And since plenty of Rishonim say it, many Acharonim say it, and it gets copied over and over again into the contemporary Sforim. But here we have a case also of Shinui HaTeva. Back in those days, they did not have stethoscope. A stethoscope is with the ears and the thing that they listen, right? Back in those days, the way the physician studied the heartbeat was to put his ear directly on the, over the heart of the patient. Oh, that's what they thought was improper for a male physician and a female patient. But somehow it's gotten copied over and over again into modern handbooks when they do it very differently nowadays. Yes. In any event, he holds it's all prohibited. Yishtaka hadavar. Let this matter be forgotten. Lo ye'amev, lo ya'aleh la'dat. Let this matter not be discussed, and let no one think about it. Halo la'achar aleda, od nosaf al ha'amur, yihyeh muchrach l'nashka. If the husband is present in the delivery room, then when the birth is finished and the baby is delivered, he's going to have to kiss his wife and say, Mazel Tov. If he doesn't kiss his wife and say, Mazel Tov, if he doesn't kiss his wife and say Mazel Tov, the attending physicians and the other medical staff will think of him as being a primitive man of the forest, a caveman, and in order to maintain his dignity, he's going to be compelled. He's going to feel himself compelled to kiss her and say Mazel Tov, and that's surely awesome. Therefore, there's absolutely no room for any leniency whatsoever. The husband cannot be present in the delivery room, even if he's facing away, even with his back to the wife, still prohibited, because she is neither, and we're going to have all kinds of horrible results. Now you'll notice in passing that he too is totally rejecting the halachic approach of Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe Feinstein said, husband wants to be present, no one knows, no one ever said that there's a prohibition for husbands to be present when wives are neither. So let him be present if he wants. The Ber Moshe says, unthinkable, just unthinkable that such a thing should ever happen. L'dorei dorot, over the generations, our parents and grandparents and great-grandparents never did such a thing, and therefore we should not start. Period.
I think that's bring up the what could happen, the potential consequences of the vow being there would be that he would have to kiss her.
Yeah. And he would feel pressured to kiss her, and he might give in to that pressure.
Can you think of any consequences? He said if there's no actual issue here, so I'm not worried about what could happen. I'm just staying out of that question.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the difference in approach here is more fundamental than you imagine. The difference in approach here revolves around the more fundamental question, in the words of the Gemara, Ein koach biyadenu ligzor gzerot hadashot. Who has the authority to create halacha, Well, the Sanhedrin had that authority because they had smicha, generation after generation, from Moshe Rabbeinu. They were an authorized legislative body. The Sanhedrin could make halacha. After the Sanhedrin, and most of the Talmudic period, most of the Gemaras after the Sanhedrin existed only a few years after the destruction of Bayis Sheni. Historians disagree about exactly how many years, but not many years. Then the Sanhedrin ceased to exist. Nonetheless, the halacha conclusions of the Gemara were mikubal, accepted by the Jewish people. So the Sanhedrin had the authority coming from Moshe Rabbeinu to legislate. The halacha created by the Gemara has the authority that the people accepted that halacha, but once the Gemara was completed, there's no longer any body anywhere which has the ability to legislate new halacha. Ein koach b'yadeinu ledzor gzerot chadashot. That was part of the battle cry of Rav Moshe Feinstein. What's usser is usser. What they did not prohibit is permitted, and we just have to be quite clear about what's what, and that's all there is to it. The Ber Moshe, on the other hand, is happy to gozer gzera chadasha. It seems that since this situation, namely presence of the husband when the wife is delivering, presence in the delivery room might, with some likelihood, lead to kissing, let us prohibit it.
So the Mincha Zitna, who saw anti-changing of halacha, has no problem to add halacha.
To maintain things to be exactly as they are.
Well, he's not maintaining, he's adding.
Okay, but he's adding it so that husbands will not start going into the delivery rooms.
But in the Ber Moshe, if you had a Torah observant doctor and nursing staff, where there would not be an expectation on the their part that the husband should kiss his wife and say mazel tov, would he then okay it, or would he go?
No, because he'd say in other cases it would be a non-Jewish or non-observant staff. I'm sure. B'shum ponim ba'olam. There's no way in the world that he would ever consider a leniency here.
But he gives that reason of the expectation of.
Yeah. Okay. Well, he was a candidate for receiving the appointment of head of the Eda Haredit here in Yerushalayim as a successor of Dayan Weiss. He was a candidate for that position, one of several, and I'm not privy to the inner workings of the Ada. I don't know exactly what the decision-making process was, but I do know that shortly after he became a candidate, he published a tshuva on exactly this kind of issue, namely, the question was, husband and wife during Nida, are they permitted or is it prohibited for them to play ping pong?
Play ping pong? Playing ping pong is us or self, of course.
Well, no, it's not throwing hand to hand. Like the ball bounces on the table first. It's not hand to hand. And even if the ball doesn't bounce, it's not actually being caught by the other person. It's being hit. It's not exactly zrika. So someone asked him whether or not it's permitted, and he wrote a tshuva on the matter. And I don't know exactly cause and effect, but I suspect the publication of that tshuva led to his name being dropped as a candidate.
It was a setup.
He said yes, they're allowed?
No, he said usher.
And that made him be dropped?
Yes. Because he discussed the possibility of playing ping pong.
This shouldn't drive it out of your mind. Shouldn't have even been a question.
Correct. Right. He discussed the possibility of playing ping pong.
That's a problem.
Okay. We're beginning to have an approach. We're beginning to have an idea of the way different poskim approach halachic issues. Now let's take a look at Rav Henkin. Rav Henkin was a grandson. He still is alive. He is a grandson of the famous Rav Henkin, Rav Eliyahu Henkin. Rav Eliyahu Henkin, the grandfather, was originally from Lithuania, ended up in New York. Rav Henkin was the Rav that Rav Moshe Feinstein considered to be the greatest rabbi in New York. He was a heavyweight. Rav Moshe Feinstein thought of him as being the most important Rav in New York. The grandson, Rav Yehuda Henkin, who lives now in Yerushalayim, published the following article in Asia. Asia is a journal published by Shari Tzedek Hospital, a journal of halachic content. Halacha is having to do with medicine. Halacha u'rifuah. It's a journal of halacha u'rifuah. Says it like this. Afalpi she'en lahatir l'ba'al l'hiyot b'chadar leida l'lo tzarech. Even though we should not permit, even though we should prohibit.
The
date of the
publication?
Yes.
So it's about
50
years ago?
Yes.
Wait, this can't be the modern Rav Henkin.
It's the grandson who wrote this.
The grandson is alive.
He's alive today.
He couldn't have written this 50 years ago.
No, 40.
Actually, I guess he could have.
Tafshin Lamed Chet was how many years ago, Tafshin Lamed Chet?
38
years ago.
It was one of his early stuff.
38 years ago.
It's in the
70s. Right. In the 70s he published this. He said, even though that we should not permit the presence, even though we should prohibit the presence of the husband in the delivery room, lilo tzarech, if there's no need, since he'll probably end up doing something prohibited there, like looking at what he shouldn't look at. And as we say, just as we say that the Nazir, who is not allowed to eat grapes, should not visit the vineyard, right? The Nazir, who asks for advice, we tell him, walk around the vineyard. Don't walk through the vineyard. You're not allowed to eat grapes. Why would you want to walk through the vineyard unless you have some need to be there? If there's no need to go through the vineyard, we tell the Nazir, why go? Similarly, the husband, if there's no need to be there, why should he be there when prohibited looking is likely? If the woman has fear, is afraid, that's why she wants the husband to be there, because she's afraid. The husband is obligated to be with the wife in the delivery room if she's afraid, and that's the reason she wants him to be there, because she's afraid, obligated to go. Where did this obligation come from? Who said that husbands have to listen to their wives?
I know his wife.
What?
I know his wife.
God did.
She's Nishmas.
Yeah. I saw her on Tuesday.
Yeah, she's Nishmas.
I saw him on Tuesday. Maybe it came from her.
God said listen to
their wives. No. Then husbands would always have to listen to wives, and that can't be true.
No, it's a call I said so much. Call. What's Gamatria call? Gamatria call is 50.
Okay.
50% of what she says, yeah.
50%. Okay. No. Yesod HaDin, the reason why he has to listen to her in this case, the reason he has to listen to his wife and be present when she's giving birth, because he's afraid in this case, the reason he has to listen to her is pikuach nefesh. Chazal ha'emidu et pachta shel yoledet kesakanat nefashot. Chazal in the Gemara already established that a woman's fear in childbirth is equivalent to threats to life, and therefore, since Chazal already established that a woman's fear in childbirth is sakanat nefashot. If this is what's needed, you have to do whatever is needed in life-saving. If what's needed here in life-saving is the presence of the husband because of her fear, so it's a chiyuv. It has nothing to do with general relations between husband and wife. It has to do with life-saving in the dangerous situation of childbirth. Now, of course, everyone knows that, well, not only in those days, even today, childbirth is a life-threatening event. Baruch Hashem, modern medicine is pretty good, and the death rate is vanishingly small, but that's only because modern medicine knows how to do things in a safe way. The event of childbirth is inherently life-threatening and must be treated as such, and any modern physician would agree with that. The example in the Gemara that he is alluding to is the example of a blind woman giving birth, a blind woman who's giving birth, and she's afraid. It's night time, she's giving birth at night, and she's afraid that the midwife, back in the days of the Gemara, the blind woman giving birth is afraid that the midwife will not be able to do her job properly unless a candle is lit. So the blind woman says, please light a candle so the midwife will be able to do her job better. The midwife says, nonsense. I do this with my eyes closed, one hand tied behind my back. Nonsense. There's quite enough moonlight. There's quite enough moonlight. I have absolutely no need for any more light. It's absolutely absurd that a candle be lit. That's what the midwife says. And she's the one who has to see, after all. The Yoledet is blind. The decision of the Gemara is because the woman in labor is afraid, that fear is sakanat nefashot, that fear increases the threat to her life. And I think any modern physician would agree with this as well, that emotional tension, whether it's in childbirth or any other traumatic experience, emotional tension, of course, increases the danger, increases the level of danger. So, of course, you have to light a candle. Of course, you have to light a candle in order to reduce her fear, because if she's more ragua, if she's more calm, that reduces threat to life.
Would the midwife be allowed to lie in this case?
So the Acharonim discuss endlessly, and many Acharonim say if you could lie and get away with it, then it's okay to lie. But or you also don't want the lady to say, why can I not smell the burning oil?
Yes, daylight out. How do you know?
Okay.
But so truly, the Bar Moshe and the Minchas Yitzchak knew this about.
Yeah, and they're going to respond to this on the next page. It follows that if she's afraid, it's not only permissible, but obligatory for the husband to listen to her and to be present. Further, Yeshnam Shnei Minei Teruf Adas. There are two kinds of stress, two kinds of tension, two categories of problems that we have to deal with. Ha'echad, the first is, Kishachole Mefached Ba'ad Gufo Shemayamut. The first kind of fear is if a patient, whether it's a woman in childbirth or any other sick person, with labor, pregnancy, labor, and delivery is not an illness, but halachically speaking, it falls under the same category as illness. All the leniencies that apply to illnesses apply equally to pregnancy, labor, and delivery. The first kind of fear is the fear that the patient has that he or she is going to die. The Rambam says that if someone is bit by a snake and he's afraid he's going to die, she's afraid she's going to die because of the snake bite, you're allowed to violate mitzvahs of the Torah, like lilhosh, recite an incantation. You can recite an incantation. Lilhosh means to recite an incantation, which normally would be prohibited. That's part of some other religion. Normally it's prohibited, but if it's life-threatening, it's okay. Hasheni, the second kind of fear, which is halachically actionable. Kishacholem mitzta'er v'do'eg shelo yekayimu et dvarav b'dvarim she'enam kshurim l'gufo. Second kind of fear is when the patient, or in this case, the woman in labor, is afraid that no one is going to listen to her. They're going to ignore her words. She would like such and such to be done, and they're going to ignore her. And that creates tension.
Do that even if the husband is there.
Oh, yeah. I want such and such, and no one listens to her. No one does what she wants. That creates tension. That creates stress and tension, unnecessarily increasing tension and stress in the childbirth is life-threatening. And the Rambam mentions this as well regarding Shchiv Meira. Shchiv Meira is someone who is dying in bed, contemplating death, and someone who's in bed contemplating death, Eino tzarich kinyan afilu b'shabbos, can determine what is to happen with his estate after he dies. What's going to happen with my property after I die? All the normal requirements of halacha in creating a will are waived, and so as to keep the dying patient calm, we just listen to what he wants for the disposition of his estate, and that's halakhically valid, even though the normal procedures are not fulfilled, since ignoring his words will increase his stress and tension. So we listen to him and we accept his words and we execute his desires, even though in other situations this would not be halachically valid. Okay, so those are two kinds of fear, either one of which is sufficient to set aside prohibitions. It says in the next page, Mekol Makom, in any event, Chilul Shabbos min HaTorah, Miyashev Hadat, nonetheless, violating Shabbos in order to settle one's mind, in order to calm someone, mutar rak violetit. Calmness allows violation of Shabbos only for women in childbirth. Lo stam holy, not an ordinary sick person. For an ordinary sick person, in order to justify violating Shabbos, we need real threat to life. For a woman in childbirth, to justify violating Shabbos, it's enough calmness. This candle issue is just nonsense. Lighting a candle is not going to help save her life. It's totally unnecessary. There, we violate Shabbos because of calmness. The calmness requirement, that has to do with women in childbirth, not with ordinary sick people. Tam HaDavar, the reason is, Stam Choleh, Eino tzarich ele lanuach le'achol ma shenotnim lo refuato bidei shamayim bidei adam. Most sick people just have to rest and do what they are told, follow their diet and eat their medicine and do their therapy. Most sick people, to get better, just have to rest and do what they are told. That's very different from a woman in labor. Just resting and doing what she is told is not enough to get through that experience. Masha Enken Yoledis is different. Srihaba Atzmalha Fleet at Avlad. A woman in labor, it's labor, it's a lot of hard work. She has to do all the work in order to deliver the baby. It's hard work on the part of the mother. He Avodah Kasha, Sriha Yeshuv Adat, the woman has to work so hard during labor and delivery, and it is very hard work, anything which will allow her to concentrate more on the work she has to do will make the whole procedure smoother and easier and less dangerous. Lefizet, Therefore, Yitrona Yoledet Legabe Yishuv Adas Yoter Meshar Chole. Therefore, women who are more lenient with women in childbirth regarding calmness issues than other sick people. Urak Ach Taflit Avlad, and the leniencies for women in childbirth, where we violate Shabbos just to keep them calm, that's until the baby has been delivered. Because once the baby has been delivered, her work is done. Now, she's like any other sick person. She isn't sick, she's perfectly healthy, but she has the same halach status as any sick person. Rest and do what you're told is all that is necessary. Aval acharei leida va'ad shlosha yamim hikechol choleh, for the first 3 days after giving birth, she has the status of any other sick person who is in a life-threatening situation. No evaluation is necessary, but one violates Shabbos for her for the first 3 days after giving birth. Okay, what he's demonstrated up to this point is that Yishuv Hada'at, calmness of the woman in labor and delivery, is of equal importance to life saving. It is part of life saving, and therefore, of course, we violate Shabbos for calmness in order to make the woman calmer in childbirth.
You'd be pro Laman.
Definitely. Definitely. This is the obvious conclusion. Mekan, the stuff in brackets I add, it's not really, what I added in brackets is not really part of the text. I just point out that the ideas that he says have good sources in Talmudic literature, which he doesn't bring. I just bring some more sources in Talmudic literature to justify what he says. And I put that in brackets because I added it. It's not part of the original text. But then the original text picks up again in the middle. Mekan, yesh ladun b'leida tivit. Therefore, we have to draw a conclusion regarding natural birth, Lamar's system or any other name that it might be called. As far as these natural birth systems are concerned, tochen hashita, the content of the method, mushi b'chodesh hashvi'i, in the 7th month of pregnancy, matchila isha b'targilim, the woman begins exercises. Mishlosha sugim, there are 3 kinds of exercises that the woman begins to practice in the 7th month of pregnancy. Piyug, relaxing, hatarat shririm, relaxing the muscles, targile nishima, breathing exercises, כדי להסיח את דעתה מן הצירים, דחיפה להפליט את האבלד. She has to practice diverting her attention from the contractions, and she has to learn how to push the baby out when the time comes. These are exercises which the woman begins in the 7th month of pregnancy. אחר שהיא מתמחית בתרגלים אלה, once she becomes an expert, once she becomes accustomed to these exercises, b'shituf im ben zug, and she does the exercises in cooperation with her husband, hamitzave aleh lahafig et ashririm umone b'shvila et anishimot v'adichivot, the husband helps her during the exercises by instructing her to relax and counting her breaths and telling her which muscles to relax. Azaihi mitragelet letzivuyo umimaleit achareihem gam kesher mitgabrim tzirei ma'od. Once she is accustomed to the teamwork between husband and wife, then she will do it correctly when the time comes, because she's accustomed to listening to his voice, counting the breaths, and relaxing the muscles that have to be relaxed. They work as a team together, and since they've built up the teamwork, all will go smoothly when the birth actually comes. As eina misugelet b'derech klal lehishtalet al atzma, when the actual birth comes, if left to her own devices, she might not be in control of herself. she needs her teammate, namely the husband, present in order to be able to control herself in the way she exercised, in the way she practiced. Afalpi, Shashita Zo Muteret, even though this system is permissible, Hayar, after all, in the seventh month of pregnancy, she's not neither. Right, they can do whatever they want with each other. She's not needed. Everything is permitted. There is clearly no prohibition in these exercises during the beginning of the seventh month of her pregnancy. Clearly, no prohibition there. Of course, it would be preferable for the pregnant woman to do the exercises not with her husband but with a girlfriend. Let her build teamwork, not with her husband. Let her build teamwork with a girlfriend, and then the girlfriend, in Israel they use this word doula. Is that word that used in Chutz La'aretz? It's a horrible, horrible word. Worse than coach. I mean, you know my objections to coach. Doula is the ordinary Greek word for a slave girl.
Oh my God.
Doula in Greek means a slave girl.
You pay them quite a bit of money. They're definitely not slaves.
Oh, okay. But, you know, like a coach is bad enough, but doula? I mean, really? Because in ancient Greece, the women would take along their slave girls when they gave birth. I didn't make up the language. I just have to live with it. So, of course, he says the pregnant woman should do the exercises and therefore build teamwork with a female, with a girlfriend, and then when labor comes, she'll call that girlfriend to help her through the difficult labor and delivery. Mekol makom, in any event, harbe pa'amim ein le'isha im milita men zulat im abal. But in many cases, the pregnant woman doesn't have any option of someone else who's going to be able to do this. While she might pay the doula, how much would it cost?
Depends on the level of the doula. It's usually between 600 and 2,000
shekels. Yeah, you've got it. Okay, well, maybe she doesn't have the money to pay a doula. Maybe the husband is the only person available from the seventh month of pregnancy to do these exercises. And there is no prohibition of teamwork between husband and wife during pregnancy. She's not neither, after all. Imkein, hu yitzterech liyot ita b'chad ha-leida. There's no one else who can do it when the labor actually begins, because they've built this teamwork. He's the one who can relieve her tension and stress. He's the one who can reduce the level of sakanat nefashot. Since there's surely no prohibition in the exercises, because she's not yet neither, therefore, if she exercises with the husband and they make it build themselves as a team, and when the labor actually begins, she's afraid to do it by herself, because she's afraid without her teammate it's not going to work. She's afraid she won't be able to control herself. Well, it follows that letlanba mechuyav lihiyot ita b'shvil pikuach nefesh, he has no choice, he must be present, because it's pikuach nefesh. He and only he can do what's necessary to reduce the tension and stress here. He and only he can do what's necessary to reduce the sakanat nefashot, the danger to life. Therefore, bottom line, he finishes the tshuva with a vigorous attack against Shaare Tzedek Medical Center. Shaare Tzedek Medical Center here in Yerushalayim is a frum place. Whole hospital is Torah observant. Not all the staff are Torah observant, but everything is officially done according to the rules of halacha. And Shari Tzedek Medical Center back in those days, had a rule prohibiting husbands from entering the delivery room. Back in those days, the hospital simply prohibited it. Other hospitals in Israel, like Hadassah, had no problem.
Wasn't it true that the delivery room then was a common delivery room and there were multiple women together?
No. Even then, you had an option of private delivery rooms. The batei cholim hamunim ba'ofen shitati min habal ba'havera liyot im hayoledet b'chadar leida. The hospitals which have a policy prohibiting the husbands or boyfriends, if it's an unmarried couple, boyfriends from being present with the woman in the delivery room when she's afraid because of the pain. Ein ruach hachamim nolchame batei cholim eila. These hospitals, like Shari Tzedek, are not in the spirit of the rabbis. Krovim liot shof chedomim, they're borderline guilty of shedding blood. Of course, the death rate is, Baruch Hashem, vanishingly small, but there still is a death rate. Mitzvah, limchot biyadam, everyone should do what they can to protest the policy of the hospitals which block the husbands from being present in the delivery room.
Am I correct in noticing that he doesn't say explicitly that there's hand-holding?
Yeah, he mentions. I feel the mashmesh, even rubbing the hands to calm the way. Now, what do we have so far? We have the Igris Moshe, who takes what I characterize as being strictly halachic approach. Then we have the Frum rabbis, the Minchas Yitzchak, and the Be'er Moshe, who take the approach which I characterize as, let us not change anything. And since for countless generations we've been doing it this way, we dare not change. As soon as you change something, the flood will come and all Torah practices will be lost. And then we have the approach of this tshuva, who takes a very different approach. He says, it's not a question of whether it's permitted or prohibited for the husband to participate in this. It's a question of whether he's obligated to or not. And since Pikuach Nefesh is obligatory, and since this is part of Pikuach Nefesh, and what makes this part of Pikuach Nefesh, that the Gemara said, and he demonstrated that the Gemara proved that reducing the fear, reducing the stress and tension of the woman in labor and childbirth is...
Where did he say you're not to hold hands?
Yeah, I'm afraid I'm not finding it.
Ah, you didn't actually have that passage?
Move on, man. Okay. Need a coach in the room.
Yeah.
Yeah, but if you're allowed to violate Shabbos,
yeah.
You're allowed to violate her husband.
Yeah. Let me take a look quickly.
Why, the other guys didn't say you couldn't violate Shabbos. The other guys, their Moshe and the Minchas Yitzchak, I'm sure, would say you could violate Shabbos. In labor.
He talks about the details of the Ramah's method.
This is one point. There are two points here. Point number one is you're correct that he's talking about the common Lamaze method, which was in use and more or less still is in use today. It's been refined since then, but basically the same methods are in use, and everyone knows that part of the method he's talking about involves touching. That's part of the issue here. The second element is that the whole thrust of the tshuva is to tell us that anything which reduces fear, stress, or tension is a fulfillment of Pikuach Nefesh, and everyone knows that Pikuach Nefesh is Doche, among other things, the Harchakot, which we have. So it's pretty clear.
Correctly, it even would be on handholding if it involved back rubbing.
Yeah, sure. Sure. Okay. Now when this tshuva was published, what was it? Tafshin Lamed Chet. When this tshuva was published, Rav Moshe Halberstam, who's one of the leading, he was one of the leading rabbanim of the Edah Haredit, passed away around 5 years ago. He was one of the leading rabbanim. He was called upon by the Edah Haredit to please stand up and refute this. Okay? So he was chosen as the representative of the Orthodox rabbis in the Edah Haredit to refute the position that we just finished looking at. Let's see what he says in refutation. Hirchik Lechet. He exaggerates. The tshuva we just finished exaggerates. Beheter zeh. He frees alamida. Hifriz alamida is exaggerate. Hirchik lechet is. I always get so confused between English and Yiddish. Far-fetched is
English.
Far-fetched is Yiddish.
Far-fetched.
That's the far-fetched
idea.
Yeah, far-fetched is English. I get confused.
Far-fetched.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, like you smear butter on the bread, you smear butter on the bread. I always get confused which is which. It's a far-fetched. In any event, it's far-fetched. From whatever language you choose.
One day we'll understand the Rav's humor before we make the joke three times.
One of my great problems in life is I don't know anything about humor. Pikuach Nefesh. He's just all wrong about Pikuach Nefesh. The tshuva was based, the leniency was based entirely upon Pikuach Nefesh, life saving, and that's just silly. The Mahuta Pachad Shel Isha, it's just silly to say there's any reality, any Mahut, any essence, any reality to fear on the part of the woman who is giving birth. Asher nachon yoter, it would be more proper to talk not about the woman's fear. Women are not afraid when they, we rabbis know about women when they give birth. They're not afraid when they go into labor. Rather, ratzon, or ratzon nimratz. The women are not afraid and therefore want their husband's presence. Instead, what's going on here is they have ratzon, they have desire, or desire nimratz, a strong desire for the husbands to be present. It has nothing to do with pachad. It has only to do with the ratzon, the desires of the woman in labor. And of course, we know how lightheaded and frivolous those ladies are. Ludvarav, according to the lenient tshuva, Im anashim tedana she'ein heter lebal lehikanes lechadar leida, if the women would just be told that it's simply asur for the husbands to be present, lo yavo l'nimuk shel pachad, they would never mention pachad. There is no pachad here, and if we would just tell them that it's simply asur, then the whole discussion of pachad would evaporate and disappear. Hare ein kan ela bakasha nochiyut yitera. The women are just concerned with their own convenience. Nochiyut, it makes life more convenient, more pleasant for them if the husbands are present, and that's all there is to it. There is no issue of pachad. There is no issue of stress and tension, and therefore there is no issue of pikuach nefesh, and therefore the whole leniency collapses. That's the approach of Moshe Halberstam.
He doesn't address the halachic reasoning of the tshuva. He addresses the underlying principle.
Exactly. Now, At this point, Rav Henkin was motivated to respond to this attack. And here is how Rav Henkin responded to the attack. Hare lema'ase. The fact is, yeshna nashim sheyesh lan pachad gadol liyot levadan. The fact is, many women in labor and delivery are afraid to be without their husbands. We disagree about the facts, you and I. Rav Halberstam says, "Fui, there is no fear in this story. It's just silly." Rav Henkin says, "No, the fear is real, and since the fear is real, the Gemara already defined that fear as being part of sakanat nefashot. Ein ze ratzon greda. It's not that the women simply want their husbands." Even if we would inform the ladies, even if we would inform the ladies that their husbands are not allowed to be present, still, they would be afraid. The fear would not vanish just because we tell them that it's usher for their husbands to be present. Therefore, lefi dvarav yomru l'sumet, according to Rav Halberstam, the Gemara should have told the blind lady. Remember the blind lady in the Gemara? According to Rav Halberstam, the rabbis in the Gemara should have told the blind lady, they should have just told the lady, "Fui, it's silly to light a candle. Just forget about it. You're not afraid."
Everyone knows it's asur to light a candle.
Yes, yes. Well, they should have told the lady, "You're not afraid. It's just silly lighting a candle. There's no need for it." After all, just tell the lady, the blind lady, that no one needs a candle. Vazlo to vacation, she won't ask for it, and the whole sugya in the Gemara, the whole passage in the Gemara should vanish, shouldn't even be there. But apparently, the rabbis in the Gemara did not think it sufficient just to tell the lady that she's silly and there's no need for the candle. And therefore, he says, I don't tell the ladies that they're just silly and not afraid. Rather, just as we accept the fear of the blind lady in the Gemara, so we accept the fear of the contemporary ladies with the same leniencies flowing. That is his conclusion.
And of course, Palestine issued a...
I didn't know that.
So, 3 again, 2-4.
Okay, well, the list can be made much. The list can be made much longer on the strict side. On the lenient side, the list cannot be made much longer. We have Moshe Feinstein, and on the lenient side, the lists are not much longer. On the strict side, you can make much longer lists.
What's your there are only a couple minutes left, and people have questions, but I want to come back to a question that I opened the series with, which you very artfully dodged on Sunday. In conversations with you, the students are all aware, and I know from my many years of calling you with a whole variety of questions, you are very often guided, reluctant as you are to actually give bottom line directive psak, you are often guided by the concept of the minhag ha-pashut. What seems to be within the community of people that are concerned with Torah and mitzvot, what seems to be the overwhelming practice as a way of guiding us? So let me ask you a factual question, but by way of hoping that you'll answer a more methodological question. What is the minhag ha-pashut in your experience in the Orthodox world, ligva meha, left, right, and center, and in this manner. And how do you see, why are you so often guided by that concept of minhag ha'pashut in giving directive and advice to people that address you?
Yeah, the facts seem to me fairly straightforward. The minhag ha'pashut, the most common actual practice in the real world, Torah observant families, Torah observant couples from Efrat, largely the husband is going to be present in the delivery room.
Yeah, I would say almost universally.
Almost universally. On the other hand, Torah observant, well, there are only Torah observant couples in my holy neighborhood. In my holy neighborhood, approximately zero.
approximately zero. Every time we've been to the delivery room, mm-hmm. there have been Haredim there as well. They have also been going in and out of the living room just as I was going in and out of the living room.
Yeah, but
different
neighborhoods, not mine. For mine, approximately zero. But the one of the many reasons that minhag ha'pashut weighs heavily in my thinking, and next year when we talk about klalei, principles of halacha, we're going to have to deal with the weight of minhag ha'makom. One of the many reasons that it weighs heavily in my thinking is that as long as everyone is on the same page, as long as everyone is happy with what's going on, all is well. The problem arises, what happens when you have someone who's growing up in that community and is not comfortable with the minhag ha'pashut of that community? And then there's tension. As long as there's no tension and everyone's happy with what's going on, I'm very tolerant and whatever they're doing is fine.
Well, there's also a difference in cases, in other words. In a case, let's say a shul community in a shul has to determine what's our position here going to be regarding this or that practice in Kriyat HaTorah or who knows what. So there, minhag ha'pashut really is very important because it's a kind of consensus view. That's the definition of a shul. A lot of people come together and accept perhaps in certain Hasidic courts where whatever the Rebbe says, that's what goes. In most of the Misnagdish world, and certainly in the modern Orthodox world, community means consensus. And it could be that I came with my custom and you came with your custom, particularly in places where it's a kibbutz goliot kind of circumstance. So we're going to find some kind of consensus. And there, turning to minhag ha'pashut, what seems to be the most widespread practice really does make a lot of sense. But here in the case of the man in the delivery room, you and I might be neighbors in a particularly Haredi neighborhood or a particularly Maaretz. What I do with my wife in my delivery room doesn't impact you and your ability to raise your family how you want. And there, you have to say consensus really is important.
From your point of view, you can say something like that because you come from a background where independence, even fierce independence, is okay. But in other societies, such independence is not acceptable. So, in any event, let's pause at this. At this point, there is no end. Ein l'davar sof. We could discuss forever, but we have to call an end to this. And we're going to be meeting again around 6:30 tonight.
Thank you.
We're going to cover this final topic.
Well, maybe I got it.
Is anybody heading into town immediately?
I'm heading into the Friday.
Shall we talk about
the
Friday? Yeah. The Friday. 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 The Fri